The following transcription is taken at the Tenno-Yukon Historical Society meeting of February 1968. The speaker is Fabian Carey, a longtime trapper in the Lake Minchumina area.
My name is Fabian Carey, and forthcoming speech or information provided with my
beginning.
The early trappers, the early trappers up here, the principal ones, are between 1840 and 1900, or say 1890, and these periods were Indians. Of course, it's well known Hudson Bay established a post at Fort Yukon in the 40s, but as near as I've been able to ascertain, there never was much activity among by white trappers in Alaska. And by the time the Hudson Bay had pushed this far north, the beaver days were dead. In fact, the last of the best beaver trapping went off in the late 1830s. By the mid 90s, there were several hundred men attracted to the Yukon Valley in the course of pursuits of gold and flash rebellions on Stewart River, which were struck in 85, and then the 40 mile a few years later. But many of these early prospectors combined trapping and prospecting. Their luck wasn't very good if they didn't secure enough by rocking or panning the bars or sniping one way or another. They turned to the pursuit of fur, and at that time bear were sold as fur bears, and so their hides were sold to the traders, and marten was easily captured with use of deadfalls. There were too many steel traps came into them in the 90s. They were principally taken by snares and deadfalls. Most of your fur. But up until the Klondike was struck and the room was struck, the activity of the interest was principally in fur, in gold, in minerals. But it sort of changed after the turn of the century, because many men came up here and the country was overrun with trappers and prospectors, and there wasn't enough good mining ground to go around to keep everybody rich and happy. So they had to turn to other pursuits. There were 75 steamboats or so on the river, and wood had to be cut for them, and there were trails. The government was busy cutting trails and building cabins here and there throughout the country. So there was a lot of incidental work furnished to men, and out of this group, the trapper emerged. There were a lot of men that fought the cordwood piles and packed mail and worked on steamboats and worked into slavish work that they followed in the gold mines, and probably the hardest work in the world, drift mining. And they decided there were other pursuits they were better fitted for or adapted to. So those were like the life on the frontier in the trees, and why it turned to trapping. And in the early 1900s, there were some good trappers around. I met a few men in later years that had trapped between 1900 and 1910 at the deadfall days, and had done well. They made big catches. Of course, catching those days wasn't taken in a matter of 90 days like it is today. Started to set their traps and prepare. It was a year-round job for them, and any month with an hour in it was a fair one to take for. They started in September, and they ran into May, and even June. They overstepped the hours a little bit for the water for bears. But that gave a long season, and as it's witness on these old grading peaks. Pine firs, and then there were two or three grades of unpine firs, depending whether they were coming in or out. You know, you had your number twos, number threes, number four grades. You can say they catered all four seasons at the fir houses. That brings us up to picking localities for early trap lines. There's a lot of Alaska, but as far as trapping in the interior goes, not all of it is a suitable country, or not all of it was ever. The Eddy, the Anoko, and General Belt Pass between McKinley Park and the Anoka River. There was also other little patches like the head of the Copper River. There was an isolated patch, and this was it in the drainage. It was a great mink and beaver and marten producer, the Yetneskwetna. And Suzette proper was a great fur country, and will probably be for all time. But that is the area that I'm most concerned with, is the Yukon drainage. I might mention too that long before man penetrated into the Yukon Valley to trap, why, of course the coast was well known. The first seal was pretty well done away with, near extermination by the 1840s. And the Russians imposed a closure, a 15-year closure. I didn't know that until recently in my writing. And it extended later than that. They had a limited catch then. They were down to around 50,000 animals by the 40s. And they ran it up to several million by the time the U.S. took over in the early 1870s. And then the forerunner of the NC Company, the AC Company, discovered it, and they adopted the same structure as Hudson's Bay did. They had it down in 1910 to where they had named for all again, so they took care of that. And the Russians did likewise with the sea otter. They were blamed for the wholesale fall of what they did at the start with, but then they imposed restrictions on the hunting in the sea otter, and that of course extended down as far as San Francisco Bay. The sea otter once went that far south, but they got the California otter pretty quick and so on up the coast, and they decimated him to the point where he couldn't be hunted. But the seal and the sea otter, of course, are quite a different story, and they're pretty well known. Another interesting aspect of the fur trade is that around about 1895, a special breed of fox, well, he wasn't special, but he was a special to this area, Prince Edward Island. There was a black fox breed here. Now, he was common on Prince Edward Island, whereas he was rare all through the north. The true black probably ran 1 to 100, whereas the silver in certain areas will go, or the silver gray so-called, will go maybe 1 to every 20 fox catch. And in some areas, I've known men trapped over here in Wood River in the Bonnefield country and in the north flank of the Alaska Range, and had their silver run as high as 1 or 7 or 8. And of course, that was the profit lay for 30 years in the foxes. Anyway, going back to Prince Edward Island, they decided that something could be done about raising them in captivity, so two brothers captured several pair and penned them up and they raised them, and they had pretty good success. At first, they didn't confine the foxes separately or in pairs. They let them all run together. And at denning time, they had trouble because the females would be a big mix-up in the pups, and they tend to kill each other's pups. And so they found out they had to isolate them at that time, and then they had good luck. Now, the first ones were selling, the skins were selling $2,500 to $5,000 1800 for your top grade. So the live ones were double that much or triple that much. They were getting as high as $20,000 a pair formed in 1910, and $10,000 a pair was about the usual price. So that created quite a business on the island, and everybody and their dog got into it, and they had a good deal of success. I mean, with a lot of good strokes of fortune struck there. But the inbreeding became a problem. Even though they swapped around, the problem of inbreeding became more and more serious. They started getting runny fox and one thing or another. Their survival rate wasn't too good. So they decided they'd get wild stock out of the Mackenzie Valley at first. And so the buyers, fall of 1913, the word went out in 12 or 13, word went out in Edmonton that premium prices were going to be paid for black fox. And that was live, you see. So started a stampede of sorts. You imagine a man who worked all year for less than $1,000, how he worked to get one black fox a year and bring him in alive. That was the trick, getting him alive. The winter time, they encountered a lot of difficulty, of course. You trap a fox and you freeze a foot. They didn't want cripples. They wanted good, healthy stock. So they didn't do too well. But for a period of years, several years after that, they hunted den. And with some success and vigor, and that the Canadian government finally had to close the season at any time on fox. They closed it in mid-July. That's about the only time fox season was closed. The pup got big enough so that you couldn't catch him. No matter how fast you can run. Well, of course, that interest spread and extended into Alaska, too. And there were a lot of fox ranches spun up here in various parts of the country. There was a pretty fair ranch at Panama along the 1910 or 20. After that, there were many. There were scabby ranches. Then mink came in, the blue fox, and well, anything that could live in a pen was eventually ranched. And you can see the evidence of it all over the country. Caved-in dens in abandoned ranches. They're not so much now, but 20 years ago, there was a lot of evidence of the old ranching days. And game commission reports record permits by the dozens and stuff whereby men were allowed to catch wild caught animals and to transport and transfer them to pens. So that got to be quite a deal. It graphically incorporated winter work with your summer work, and you had box traps all going and bring in the long season. For instance, at Manchuna, there was a 3 or 4 box ranches, and practically any lake down, any lake where they could secure dog feed, fish, or they fed them trout. In one lake, there was a fox ranch, and they stopped lake job thousands through a fox. And then, of course, the miners and the camp fishermen had to feed their dogs trout, and whatever was handy, too. But there were some big years, and it's funny that the one ranch left, except for the government's own ranch at Petersburg, their experimental farm. An old friend of mine commented on it. He said that from about 1915, a friend of his was going to raise muskrats in Yukon Flat. And he shipped outside and got several rolls of wire. So when the wire got up to Beaver, I think you know the guy, Charlie, Dick Morris. So when the wire got to Beaver, there was a big powwow there among the travelers, and they all decided that this fellow was wasting his time, that if he fenced in this lake, that he'd eat more rats out than he kept eating. So they convinced him not to go to the lake, because they didn't want to fish. Right.
play with livestock back and forth. That was the gimmick. And when you were a kid, you could probably remember. And now, by all the rest of those days, is the beaver ranching. And I see the FEC's after the beaver ranches now because they're getting as high as $2,000 or $3,000 a pair, I guess, for beaver. And even if beaver bred like guinea pigs, for 19 generations, you couldn't get your money back. You know, really. So they're closing in on
diesel owners now, too. So it doesn't leave
much of anything except the mink ranch for today, as we know. And I don't know if there's any in Alaska. One of the first questions that a boy asked, or a person will ask when somebody with trap lines and trap gun comes up, is, what gun do you use, or what gun shall I take? Probably a well-intended question, but a rifle is probably the least valuable item on the trapper's equipment. When you come right down to the cases, you might use it.
It's a necessary item, all right, but compared to many of his other workaday tools, it's valuable small. And actually, a man can make his way in the woods for an extended period of time better with an axe than you can with a rifle. And that's easily evidenced by these fellows that go out and get in trouble with an airplane. They're about all their rifles good for is shoot themselves with. If they had a good sharp action, could make a good stuff at camp and cut wood. And you can make dead falls and set traps with an axe. You take care of yourself. An axe is a cutting tool, and that's what you really need when you're in the woods. And I'm a subject of firearms. There wasn't much debate up here among the trappers. There were certain rifles they settled to. The 30 Army or the 30-40 Krag. And then when the Newtons came in, the 30 Newton, the 35 Newton, and then the old Model 95 Winchesters in the... Not all the white trappers built their own
because they birch would break up under heavy loads. In the matter of partnerships, that's always been interesting for me to an interesting study for me. Most of the northerners were loners. There were partnerships affected, and some of them were good. But for the most part, most men preferred to fight the wilderness alone. There were a lot of complications attended to partnership. If you had a good partner, it was an unbeatable situation. But in many instances, there'd be conflicts of opinions and ideas, or another area that is often certain amount of trouble generated was dividing up the up trap line in the country so that each one had about the equal access to equal amount of the fur, so they could do about the same. And that the way the wood is, the fur isn't distributed evenly or uniformly, so it'd be pretty hard to it was pretty hard to divide it up and line up on those terms. One partner might be trapping in the hills or foothills, and he might have principally Martin on his line, and the season might be closed on Martin. So they'd have to, then two of them would have to concentrate maybe in a little area that they had that would produce mink or Martin or some lawful fur that could be pursued there. And there were a lot of complications in that area too. And of course, the old subject who did the most work comes up, and who put up the most money, if the partnership could endure the first 2 or 3 years of organization and the hard grinding work of building a trap line, chances are that it'd survive. But then many times too, one or the other would lose interest, and one would sell out to the other, or maybe part on friendly terms. But trapping isn't a field that every man can devote any long period of years to. For one thing, the loneliness is overwhelming to a lot of men. There's no way a person can judge or gauge his ability to live alone or stand the solitary existence until he goes out there and attempts it. And some do well, and some feel it's a mark of manliness. I've noted that among friends in the past. They feel that it's a manly ability to be able to go out and see nobody for 6 months, or don't say a word from the time the ice stops running in the fall until it breaks up in the spring. But it's quite a test. You learn to know yourself, and a lot of men will come out of the woods, and they'll just say never again. They wouldn't attempt it. They wouldn't. They'll never describe what mental gymnastics or problems they had while they were out there. But they just won't sign up for more. That's all. There's others that take to it pretty well. They learn to live with themselves, and they can stand the silence, and it gets quiet enough that your ears ring. You know, I'll call you here for maybe days when your party hood's up or something like that. Of course, the radio changed a lot. Long about 23, the radio came into Anchorage, but not many trappers had sets, and the early sets were poor, and then when they went to wet batteries, you always had either tube trouble or you couldn't keep your batteries charged. Nobody had chargers out there, so they had what they call wind chargers, but they didn't work very well. The wind never seemed to blow long enough to get 15 minutes of news once a week. It was always something the matter with that. But they had a break anyway. And then the airplane, too, when the airplane came in the mid-20s, when you could hear an airplane once in a while, and you knew that you weren't alone in the world. And then there was always the thought that not everybody lived in complete isolation like that. But there is this country even today, and in fact today it's probably worse than it was then, except that you hear a jet once in a while. But their relationship to the earth is so far and remote from a man on foot on the ground that you just discount them, you know, and they're in another world. But you do a lot of soul searching anyway when you're alone. And I recall reading one of Franken's books. He points out that he spent one winter on the east coast of Greenland alone. And he said he pumped and exhausted his brain and every thought in it. You go backward and forward, and I'll agree with him. You certainly wear out every thought in your head. When I was 19 years old, I went in the woods and the 12th of August, and I came out the 9th of the following March, and I hadn't seen anybody. And that was hitting a pretty good lick. I was there looking back, I know I wouldn't want to do it again, but I was interested, and everything was new to me, and I was willing to learn, and time flew. But that's the whole trick. You have to be interested in it, because otherwise the woods becomes a giant prison. You go out there, and you're not interested. Well, then you're in for a long winter, you know. You're climbing the walls, and terrible torments. You don't want any worries on your mind either. You don't want to go into a wood with a skin full of throttle. Well, we can depart from that now. Just living alone is just something that's hard to describe. It just has to be lived. I'm going to talk a little about roughing it. I was going to attempt a little story on that one. This idea of this business of going out in the woods and living tough, there's no requirements to it at all. Anybody can do it. All you got to do is just go out and forego your food, shelter, and clothing. That's three things that it's all about, you know. But the mark of a woodsman is how comfortable he lives in the woods. It isn't how tough he makes it for himself. Because I know, among the old trappers I've known, I've seen a good many of them that were really misfits. They'd spent years in the woods, and yet they hadn't troubled to learn the rules of the road. They abused themselves unmercifully. They just didn't use their head. And as a consequence, they suffered for it. A fellow named Kephart once wrote that the less you care, the more you carry in your head, the less you pack on your back. And that's a pretty good motto for the woods. I think about this one old trapper, a fellow named Sisson. He drifted in from the Canadian side, and he trapped on the Mackenzie, Lower Mackenzie for years, and finally came over and drifted into the Yukon Flats, and he was sort of a Wolverine type. He was tougher than the devil. And he finally settled down over in what they call a promised land. That's a patch of country between Beaver Creek, where the head of Victoria Creek and Livengood, and it includes the head of Hess Creek and Lost Creek and Rogers Creek and some of those. It's just a jungle. It's not mountainous country, but it's rough, ragged, hilly terrain, and it's cut with shotgun valleys and steep ridges and black timber. It's never burned much. It's a good mining country. But you have to work to get in and get out of it. It's hard to get an outfit in. You can't get much in by plane. You put it out to pack it in on your back, and what a man packs it on his back for a winter doesn't amount to much. Well, Sisson didn't use dogs or anything. Well, the one time he prevailed on a friend of mine to go trapping with him, go on a little junket with him. That was just before the war broke out, and this friend of mine was a big skookum fella and a good walker too. So they each took pretty well loaded packs. Left Livengood, and they had to walk 40 miles to get to his headquarters. So they put in 220-mile days in the neighborhood. It was in October, and they stumbled around, and there were long days. And along about the end of the second day, the old man looks up ahead. He was no spring chicken, and then he just was going around, toughness, you know. He looked ahead, and he saw a rock bluff up the valley, and he says, "That's from my camp. We'll be in camp now pretty quick. Everything will be fine." So, the kid stumbled along behind him, and a little while and they're on the point of this hill, and up against the bluff, the old man's got a pile of poles leaned against the hill, not to keep the starlight out, you know, that's about all. And at one end, there's a piece of ragged canvas that the bear had torn to ribbons, and then he's got two 5-gallon gas cans jammed together, and kept with sticks of rusty old stovepipe sticking out of that, and he says, well, we're home now. The kid eyeballed it, and he thought, well, this is a home camp. I don't want to see what these line camps look like. Looks like a pretty tough outfit. But they scattered a little moss and boughs around the place, and didn't make it any warmer, but the old man seemed content with it, and he added a little brush to the back of it so the breeze wouldn't rush through. And the front was open so that you could check the weather, you see. You didn't have to open the door that way, and you knew right what, just exactly what you had in the morning to start out in. So, look around that camp for the day, it seemed pretty important to the old man to get a little lit up. Well, the way the camp was built, it'd probably take 100 crores of winter, you know, to stop there. So it would be important in a place like that. The next day, the old man persuaded him to march up the trail a day and look at another camp. And they went up there, and the rest of them were what they call wiki-ups. Wiki-up is a way out in the Old West. It's a different type of shelter than it is up here. Well, the wiki-up, build it originally, you come up about 3 rounds in your log, so you go 3 logs high, it'll give you a little wall, and then you'd cut a couple of 4-inch poles and stand one at each end, and put a ridge pole between them, or a ridge between those two poles, and then you'd stack poles up on the sides to the ridge. In other words, it'd be just like a big wood tent. And it was hard to hold dirt on them. You could pull a lot of moss on, but they were at quite a slope. And bears would walk on them too, so you'd have to throw, in the summer, you'd have access to them, you'd have to throw a lot of brush on them, you know, to discourage the bears. And they were pretty miserable affairs, but the old man, he seemed to think that they were just a thing for him. Anyway, this friend of mine gave it one look, and he decided that with a little bit, he was going out of your way a little bit too much, you know, just to be out in the woods, so he beat his way back alive and good. Yet this old fella continued on like that right to the end. I had occasion to follow him only once. It was a common place for trappers to follow logging too, you know, up here. There wasn't too much logging, but about the last log drive they had here, we went up to Saltra River and brought down 4,500 logs. And the old man was alone on that drive. There were 5 or 6 of us, a couple of Indians and 4 or 5 of us white trappers. And it rained all the time we went up the river and down. Well, that's part of the game, you know, when you're wet all the time anyway. But we come into camp, we make camp on a different bar every night, and I can still see this old boy going out with us. 5 of us would huddle under a fly. We'd put up a fly and put a little campfire and try to dry out our clothes or just get them to a damp stage, you know. And the old man would wander around in the bar until he found a nice, smooth stone. It generally be one about, as I recall, 7 or 8 inches. It'd be oval rather than round. About 7 or 8 inches by about 5 inches and well round in crown, maybe 4 inches thick. So they're careful selecting that. That'd be his pillow. And he wouldn't put a shoe on it or anything. No cloth or anything. He'd sleep in, you know, a stone is just the temperature of the air about it. And it wasn't while it was summer, but it was 40 degrees, you know, with a stone, and you had wet stone on your head all night. It wouldn't appeal to me. He'd dig a hole in the barn, pick out the rocks that didn't suit the shape of his ribs and throw those away, and then he'd lay down there and pull a wet blanket over and lay in the rain all night. Night after night. He'd return to the state of the animals, you know, and the very animals that he pursued, so he didn't have any problem. But not everybody lived like that. Some men prided themselves in keeping a good camp and were so
chipped, and when they built a cabin, they weren't afraid to write their name on the door and things like that, you know. The Scandinavians were probably the best equipped and suited for trapping. They're generally fine workers, Swedes and Norwegians. There weren't too many Finns that trapped. The only reason I can see is that the Finns, they're fine woodsmen, but I don't think they like solitude too well. They like whiskey and they didn't like solitude, so I kind of kept them separated. Because drinking men, it's just impossible to be a drinker and to be a trapper, that's all. It's a solitary, you're going to do one or the other. There's been trappers that turned to drinking, but there haven't been drinkers that turned to trapping. In the summertime, there were several things a trapper turned his hand to. That's in the years when man worked at it full time. The general practice was to follow the ice out in the spring, generally get out the end of May or early June, unless you were going to rap. If you were up in Yukon Flats, you'd hunt rats until the end of May, early June, depending on the breakup, and then come out in mid-June. But if you weren't after muskrats and if you got your beaver, for years we shot beaver too. They hunted them with the rifle, and it wasn't until 1940 was the end of it. But up until 1940, a big part of the beaver taken in the north were taken with the rifle. The .22 special were considered to be beaver rifles, .22 high power to a certain extent. But they come out in the spring, and then about the 5th of June is mosquito time, and that officially closes the woods for about 30 days. Anybody but an insane man, you know. And from the 5th of June till about the 15th of July, most fellows get out, and if they want to fish for the summer, they go down to the larger rivers, and they'd get a fish wheel built in June, and generally by the end of June, the king salmon would be running, and they'd want to get a few of them, or by the 4th of July for sure, they'd want to have their wheel journey, and then they'd put up dog feed for the summer, and they'd get a garden in, they'd have to get to their main camp on the river. A lot of them would plant small gardens before they left their camp in the woods and take a chance on the rabbits and the moose, not cleaning them out. Generally, potatoes would be left pretty well alone, but it was folly to try to leave lettuce or cabbage or any of the leaf vegetables like that. You're just working to accommodate the rabbits. So then too in the summer, some fish with nets, so you have to make nets, gill nets generally, and put up white fish, you dry fish, and you put up fish strips, you put up salmon bellies. In the end of July would be berries, early August, cranberries, some dried fish. Some didn't turn their hand too much to the woods like that, but most did. And then in the late spring too, you might jerk meat, dry meat. In April and May air is good for dry meat. And about 15th of August, a little before, as soon as the willows showed the leaves, all they had to do was indicate the leaves were changed. The grayling when they came down. The whitefish were on about
September, there's spawn in the lakes, 15th to 20th. Some gravel bottom lakes will come in and spawn. And then, of course, you have to put up your moose. And in the early days, why, the men would go to the foothills and lay up enough caribou for a dog. If you had four dogs, it would take 75 caribou, and you had to take a chance on the rain not spoiling the meat. You had to take a chance on the bears. I've seen places on the islands of McKinley. McKinley fork of the Quim, on the east fork of the crest of Quim, and then, of course, in the Arctic, you see it too, where they'd be built high caches. Favorite 14 foot caches. You build a cache that would hold maybe 30 caribou. You wouldn't want to change. Too many. Once in a while, a grizzly would chew off the coast, you know, and you'd give them a lot of meat until you had a kind of. Scatter your meat. You not put all your eggs in one basket, like you say. But moose would be the same way. The moose was mostly killed. If they were feeding dogs and them, mostly killed as needed. Or snared. They snared moose to a certain extent. And the figure of moose is a 100 fish. Moose is 3 barrels of fish. And I don't know, a lot of guys that have said meat, I got educated on meat pretty early in life. If you monkey around with meat, you can't do much trapping because you're in a feeding business all the time. You never quite get around to trapping because you got to go over all the way with meat. And you get so fed up with that and you find out that with a barrel of fish, there's only 35 fish in a barrel. And we have 5 dogs. Well, that's a week official. You see, 55 pounds or 60 pounds of fish will put you in the field for a week, and 55 pounds of meat. Well, most a dog will feed 8 to 10 pounds of meat a day, and I don't know if you feed them. And caribou, you just cut them about 5 ways. And there's little winter caribou. There's much to them. There's just no hope when you're monkeying with meat. The only salvation for the fellows that did, in the first place they had to, if they were going to stay out there, and in the second place, they had their own trapping season, you see, so they had plenty of time to get around to trapping, you know. Out of a 6 or 7 month trapping season, they probably killed 30 days trapping, so the rest of it would be great meat and hunting, you know. They really got a lot of hunting experience. But anybody that gets his hunting experience that way, I'll tell you, he doesn't get too eager anymore for Christmas September to go around and kill something, you know. He hopes that everything in his world will continue to run around at 4 feet. Do I have any more time?
Yes, I would like
to. Yeah? On the subject of bears, though, that's been so overdone, I don't want to touch on it much, except that the trap and the bear are hereditary enemies and lifelong enemies. There's no other way out. I mean, they're opposed positions. You might say, at all times. The black bear is a nuisance, pure and simple. And he's into everything that the trapper holds dear, so consequently, he's dealt with accordingly. But he's not out in the winter, and as long as he doesn't come around to make a nuisance of himself, he's pretty well left alone. Especially after the years that they were no longer hunted for fur. You see, the black bear was extensively trapped until all through the 1920s. And for 100 years, they were used, they furnished the headgear for all the armies of Europe. The black bear marched with Napoleon's army and past the Napoleonic campaigns right on through the Crimean Wars and everywhere, you know. British used the Russians, back in all the armies, Europe used Buskins and Shakos and one thing and another, and it took an awful lot of bear. But you look past the fact that they were used here for robes and one thing and another. But they were trapped, and so they were trapped extensively with the steel trap and in deadfall. And the grizzly fell prey to
Thank you.